Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. The internet can be a force for good, but has it destroyed San Francisco?
I was in the Mission District, which is like the high water mark of gentrification. And, you know, you could see families who'd been living in these apartments for 50 years just be getting evicted so that their landlords could eventually convert this into a space for people who are working for Facebook or for Google.
Author Jarrett Kobeck explains his surprise hit novel, I Hate the Internet. First, though, a story of eviction and its impact right here on our doorstep. Ruth Frank, 94, and Isaac Benjamin, 95, are residents of Vintage Westwood Horizons. That's an independent living facility for seniors in Westwood Village.
I feel we came here to live, not to leave. It's our home. And we've made friends that are now our family. And it's very important that we be together and enjoy each other's company. And we want to stay. It's just right for us.
There are about 150 to 200 people living here, all senior citizens, all in various stages of disrepair, some in the state of dementia, many using walkers to navigate, a lot of them use canes, and probably the average age here is 85 to 100. And this is the population that's being evicted. And this is something that's indecent that's happening. It's indecent and it's immoral.
The pink and grey 14-storey tower with a high-ceiling lobby and generous dining room had a past life as a student dormitory. Since then, it's had multiple owners. The last one, Vintage, drew up plans for improving the facility with renters in place. Then it was bought by Tucson-based Watermark Retirement Communities, and it was renamed Watermark at Westwood Village. Now, that wasn't the only change. Ruth Frank's daughter, Janine Frank, explains what happened.
The company, Watermark, they had a meeting that was sort of billed a week ago as, you know, meet our new Watermark family. So people came to the meeting to meet the new executives, and they talked about investing $50 million in making this building state-of-the-art. Some of the residents, their mouths were watering about how gorgeous and what they were going to do. And then they said, now there's a little issue is that everyone will have to vacate the building probably for up to 2 years, and you have 120 days. I thought people were just going to have a heart attack and die when they heard that. I almost did. I was there. The truth is, if you're over 62, you have a year. But they didn't say that. The next day, there was an eviction notice posted on everyone's door that told them they had till March 28th. It was horrible.
I think their primary purpose was to get out of rent control so they can raise the rates here.
Absolutely.
And we've already been approved to do it two floors or three floors at a time and then just relocate the people in the empty rooms that are here. And nobody would have had a panic or do anything, but they didn't handle it that way. They are in it, obviously, for profit, and I think they, you know, they deserve a profit, but not at an inhuman kind of a way.
That was 95-year-old Florence, or Flossie, Liebman. At this point, the new owners, Watermark, learned that perhaps they were messing with the wrong people. Vintage describes its community as, quote, successful, creative, and well-educated seniors. Well, these residents have successful and well-educated and loving children with connections. Here's Janine Frank again.
We have a lot of people here that have participated in civic life. They know people. Their kids know people. We're in public life. We're in entertainment business. We're in academic life. We have a lot of connections, obviously.
These kids jumped into action, reaching out to local politicians and media, and they packed what was intended to be a private meeting between owners and residents. Dolores Benjamin, wife of Isaac and resident at Westwood Horizons, recalls the meeting that took place last Thursday.
It was fantastic because there were many children there. It was a very good meeting. There wasn't enough room. Half the people were standing because there were so many children. It was wonderful from that standpoint.
TV news crews were there. However, they weren't allowed into the meeting itself. But Eitan Aram, staff writer for the Jewish Journal, did get in.
It was pretty wild. I would say the room was somewhere between 200 to 300 people. And you could tell people were not happy in that crowd when the lawyer for Watermark, which is the new owner, came on and started speaking. He got booed, and I can say that I've never heard a crowd of senior citizens boo anybody. It was quite something. Paul Koretz, the city council member, came out. He made a little pun and called it a low watermark of the company's history. Representatives from Supervisor Sheila Kuehl, Assemblymember Sebastian Ridley Thomas, representatives from the mayor were there. All of them offered their support and said that they would be looking into it. But the consensus did seem to be that the eviction was legal, and so it looks like it's going to proceed.
Tenants at Westwood Horizons have now been told that they do have up to a year to leave. But in today's LA City Council meeting, Councilman Koretz asked a number of city officers to look at possible ways to stop the evictions. He also began what he calls a pressure campaign against Watermark. Meanwhile, some of the residents are getting legal advice from BetSedek. That's a nonprofit providing legal services to low-income groups and others in need. Jesse Kornberg is the CEO and president. We asked her if she believes the owners are meeting the provisions of the Ellis Act, which allows landlords to evict tenants for the purpose of going out of business.
In its most basic form, the Ellis Act provides some landlord and some residents protections when a residential building changes its use and becomes a different kind of commercial property. In this case, there is a question as to whether or not that's what's actually happening. The plan is for these residents to leave this building, for them to perform some renovation, and then for residents very much like those already in the building to come back in and be housed in a facility that provides very similar services to the ones already in place. And so we do have some questions about whether or not the Ellis Act applies for this building.
If it doesn't apply, do the residents have any cause for having this action reversed?
Potentially, yes. We are still getting all of the facts and investigating all of the possible remedies and protections available for residents in the building. And one may be to challenge these evictions and these Ellis Act notifications as being inappropriate in this case.
Many renters in LA right now fear an eviction notice. According to an LA Times report, in April, more than 1,000 rent control apartments were taken off the market last year. That's a nearly threefold increase since 2013. For seniors, the threat is even more acute, says Jesse Kornberg.
For our senior clients, the threat of eviction is not just destabilizing, but life-threatening. Many of the clients we serve throughout the city, and in this building in particular, are bedbound, are suffering from late-stage Alzheimer's, are totally incapable of navigating the process of transitioning to new housing. That's assuming that new housing were even available. So the fight right now to protect those affordable units that we have for frail and aging seniors is at a fever pitch, because the market incentives for landlords who wish to transition from affordable units to luxury ones are very, very attractive.
Watermark, the new owner of Westwood Horizons, wants to transform the center from an independent senior living center to a licensed assisted living facility. We wanted to ask Watermark why residents needed to be moved out to make these changes. At the building, the executive director, Alison Marty, declined an interview and instead sent us a statement from the company, which reads in part that they plan an extensive overhaul and that, quote, to remain during construction and renovation would be too great a risk to resident and associate safety. Critics like Flossie Liebman's daughter Jane Blumenfeld, who's also a former planner for the City of Los Angeles, says this is all about getting out from under rent control and being able to charge more for services that the center already unofficially provides just without a license.
They bought it, obviously, with this business plan in mind, you know, remodel it, get rid of these low rents, and have a high-end facility in the middle of Westwood Village, which, by the way, has a specific plan that would never allow a high-rise building ever again if anybody took it down. So it would be literally the only high-rise structure there with units, whether they're assisted living or apartments or whatever they are.
In the face of the negative publicity it's received, will Watermark soften their position? Jack Goldfarb is an LA resident whose 99-year-old father, Joe Goldfarb, lives at Vintage.
Money talks a lot louder than any reaction that people are going to have. I mean, this is a $50 million renovation they're planning, supposedly. I mean, you're talking about huge dollars here. So I don't think they care about the bad press. They knew they were going to get bad press. And they really don't care. They're just forging ahead with their plan. And their plan is to make a lot of money when they're done with this place, because they will have a premier facility and location, more importantly.
So what do the residents do now? Some are taking a wait-and-see approach. After all, says Jane Blumenfeld, the owners still have to get approvals and permits for a project to secure an Ellis Act eviction.
They also, you know, need to follow a lot of other rules about what they're allowed to do in Westwood. And it's clear, to me at least, that there's many ways to remodel this building and upgrade it that doesn't necessarily have to involve throwing out 200 seniors to the streets where there are no places for them to go to.
Others have rushed to find new accommodations, and they found that options are limited. Sherilyn Lopez had flown in from Austin to celebrate her mother's 95th birthday.
You said she's on a waiting list for a new place. And what does she have to wait for? What has to happen for her to get that place?
Somebody has to pass, which is really sad. You're on a waiting list waiting for somebody to pass on. That's like somebody waiting for my mom to pass to get her room, you know? It's not right. But, you know, it's business is business, I guess. That's what it is, big business, elderly people.
That was Sherilyn Lopez, one of the many children of residents at Vintage Westwood Horizons who face eviction from the building's new owners. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, what's the connection between evictions and the most game-changing invention of our time, the internet?
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Can tech kill a city? Can it create a president?
I think Trump is the unintended consequence of what happens when people who don't have a huge amount of experience with humanity create modes of expression that then are extended to the entire human race and become dominant modes of expression.
That's Jarrett Kobeck. He's the LA-based author of I Hate the Internet. Now, this is a novel of ideas. You might call it a screed. I Hate the Internet is subtitled A Useful Novel Against Men, Money, and the Filth of Instagram. And it is built around the stories of several characters, primarily two women whose lives are upended when they wind up being publicly shamed online. Along the way, the narrative, made up of short, punchy, seemingly random chapters, takes potshots at a wide range of targets, including, but not limited to, the white male patriarchy, Google buses, millennial posturing, exploitation of comic book writers, exploitation of all of us who generate ad sales for Silicon Valley titans by posting pictures and thoughts online. In the event you're thinking all of this sounds rather too heavy, the writing is hilarious and biting. Just take this description of San Francisco.
San Francisco had two distinctions. One, it was the most beautiful city in America. Two, it was filled with the most annoying people in America. It had always been like this from the beginning. The merit of any moment in San Francisco could be measured by a simple question. Was the beauty of the city outweighing its annoying citizens?
Or the absurdity of the $25 million valuation for a startup named Bromato by an investor character in the book called Eric Willems.
And Willems could have arrived at an equally valid number by standing in Golden Gate Park's Sharon Meadow, the place where all the old hippies held drum circles, counting the number of farts that drifted beneath his nose and multiplying the number by 1 million.
Kobeck wrote the book in 2014 and then spent a year trying to get it published. Eventually, he and two friends in the tech industry created their own publishing house and released I Hate the Internet with a bold red cover earlier this year. Then the book gained traction, and America gained a president who'd marketed himself on Twitter, and global interest grew. Now it has been published in several languages, and Kobeck just returned from a European book tour.
And the Germans brought me over to Frankfurt for the book fair for this appalling launch of their version of the book, where they, you know, this is my publisher in Germany. They published Thomas Mann. They published Franz Kafka. They survived the Nazis honorably. And they're like, well, we're doing our first stunt ever for your book. And they converted their huge booth at the fair into this, like, I Hate the Internet orgy, essentially. It was like attending your own funeral, because there's pictures of you, there's banners. And they replaced every book in their booth with a copy of the German edition of the book. So it was this 2,000 square foot sea of red. And they had branded cups and they had branded beer and all of this stuff. And it is going to take years of therapy.
For you to deal with this.
Yeah, to get to the end of it.
So it may have felt like your funeral, but presumably for the Frankfurt Book Fair, this book for them was their coming out party, because for them, it's a validation of books.
Right.
So were you anxious about the internet? Is that what prompted you to write this book with this title, I Hate the Internet?
No, I wasn't anxious about it. I was just angry. I'd been in LA for a few years, and then I moved to San Francisco. And for the first year, it was okay. And the city hadn't gone particularly crazy. And then the second year that I was there, which was 2011, is when it really started to go crazy. And
crazy in what way?
In terms of the gentrification, in terms of the mad valuations of companies that could never possibly make money, and in terms of the social effects that that was having on the basic constituent makeup of the city. I was in the Mission District, which is like the high water mark of gentrification. And, you know, you could see families who'd been living in these apartments for 50 years just be getting evicted so that their landlords could eventually convert this into a space for people who were working for Facebook or for Google. And while this was happening, the Arab Spring was also happening. And so the media narrative about what was happening with these companies was, well, they're bringing freedom to the oppressed peoples of the world. And then you could open your door and just see the oppressed peoples of the world being oppressed by the people who apparently were bringing this freedom to the oppressed peoples of the world.
And by the way, your book, which sprays critiques at an enormous number of topics, one of which is the false claim surrounding the internet's role in the Arab
right.
Spring. So quickly.
Well, I mean, I went to Egypt 4 weeks after Mubarak fell, and I talked to not a huge amount of people, but enough people who were talking about why they were in the revolution and all of this stuff, and none of them mentioned Twitter. None of them mentioned Facebook. They mentioned money and how they had none. And the only thing I saw related to Facebook was someone had stenciled the logo on a wall, and I assume they paid for it.
So anyway, you go to San Francisco in, I think, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't go to work for a big tech company?
No. I went because I was deluded and thought that this sort of bohemian vision of San Francisco that has been embedded in the culture still had validity. And then I was just sorely disabused of that, because you could see these people, like the remnants of that bohemian culture, just leaving every week. And so in the novel, it sort of ends where everyone is left.
Everyone who's bohemian.
Everyone who's useless at making money has left. And, you know, that was very much my experience. And I was one of them. I was useless at making money. I got gentrified out.
To what extent does one of the great innovations of the internet, Airbnb, contribute to this story?
I think the thing that's interesting about that is no one knows. We know it's having a huge, huge impact on rents. Even in LA, it's enormous. There are all of these apartments that essentially are empty that then get rented as temporary hotels, and it's a much better business model.
And meanwhile, you have folks piling into warehouses that then burn down.
Exactly, yeah.
But you say that 2011, things start going really crazy. You've got Google, Facebook taking over these spaces. But you say they are just part of this wholesale proliferation of startups, and that these startups that are fueled by venture capital investment, which often are somewhat pointless in their enterprise. Talk about that piece
of it. The point of those companies is never to have a viable business. The point of those companies is for initial investors to make a turnover at an IPO or at something down the line. So it's a very peculiar model. If you think about Peter Thiel, I think his initial investment in Facebook was really small. And then when Facebook IPO'd, it was worth $1 billion or $2 billion. And that's, you know, Facebook is actually a profitable company, but the rest of them kind of aren't.
Because that seems to be your point. You say that leaving aside the internet companies that really do make a profit and they do seem to provide some kind of use, however much you might say there's negatives to it, you're talking also about these companies that are really utterly useless.
Right.
And you cite one, you have a whole story about a company called Bromato, and your point is that they are pushing out businesses that actually make money.
Right.
So it's displacing functioning businesses are being gotten rid of.
And I think the city has completely drained out of functioning businesses. It's become a one-industry town. And, you know, the history of American cities is when a city becomes a one-industry town, it eventually ends up disastrous for that city.
Like Detroit?
Detroit's a good example. There's lots of manufacturing towns all across the Midwest where that one company was the town or that one industry was the city. And eventually it goes away. I mean, there's an argument, there's a question, and I don't know what the answer to it is. Are we in a moment of this kind of imaginary capitalism where that's just sustainable indefinitely, or is there a corrective coming where you can't just have a city based around companies that do nothing? But maybe there isn't. Maybe that's just the world we live in now. Maybe that's the future, that this really high level of sort of imaginary late period capitalism is something that's sustainable indefinitely. And that's horrifying if it is, because then you really could have San Francisco be a hollowed out husk indefinitely, and the people who run it would be fine with it.
Your book is full of extremely pithy and funny quotes and statements, and there will be people who will quibble with probably every critique that you make, starting with, hang on a sec, Jared, how can you hate the internet? The success of your book has been partly stimulated by the internet. I found you on the internet.
Right.
You know, how bad can it be?
I had a different answer a couple of weeks ago, but now I have a much better answer, which is if anyone thinks that finding a new book on the internet outweighs the election of a fascist to the presidency of the United States, they're insane.
Okay, you've brought up a very interesting topic. We at the station can't make explicit our political leanings. But in terms of this recent election, to what extent is our president-elect a creation of the internet?
Oh, I think the election only makes sense if you view it through the internet. What Trump and the people around Trump were really quite good at was realizing that you could run a political campaign at the emotional and intellectual frequencies of the internet, and that would be completely disruptive of the normal political model. And it happened to be that he was in an election with a lot of people who were on the emotional and intellectual frequencies of a very sort of mainstream political dialogue at the moment where the economic system in which we live had failed so many people that that normal frequency held no appeal. And so what you can see those debates, which Trump was really criticized for his performance in the debates, but I think actually what happened is he was just conducting an internet flame war. And the flame war's point is never to score, you know, a normal debating victory. It's to make the opponent look as ridiculous as possible. I mean, this has been going on since, I don't know, this has been going on as long as I think people have been arguing about things on the internet. There's someone who will make a very impassioned and well-reasoned debate about atheism, and then someone will come in and just be like, well, you're an idiot. And then the person who is so invested in this original debating point. It's like, how can you think I'm an idiot? And then you just immediately end up in this thing where you can't help but look terrible. Everyone has always lost these debates on the internet by thinking that you can interact with the 15-year-old who's calling you a moron. And so I think that's actually was the way by which Trump made his way toward victory. It was just by taking this very internet-derived style of debate, style of public address, and just watching other people crash up against it and sort of make fools of themselves in the process.
But that style of debate, that style of just slamming people down with insults, is equal opportunity. I mean, people of all persuasions, all genders, are vulgar, boastful, abusive, mm-hmm. they lie. Mm-hmm. So isn't Trump sort of an extension of all of us? Has the internet not enabled a kind of coarseness of language, of interaction that everybody has jumped in on?
Right. And I'm no better in that at all. I mean, this book is extraordinarily coarse. And that was by design, because the idea was how do you write about the internet without really embracing the language of the internet and the style of the internet? And, I think you're right. I mean, I think everyone has had a sort of coarseness unleashed from the internet.
Is it ironic that the cities that probably are the bluest, mm-hmm. San Francisco and right. Los Angeles, contain the tech industry and Hollywood, mm-hmm. from which Trump has emerged?
Of course it is. I actually think Hollywood has more blood on its hands there, because with LA and with the entertainment industry, I think it was quite intentional. Whereas with Silicon Valley, I think Trump is the unintended consequence of what happens when people who don't have a huge amount of experience with humanity create modes of expression that then are extended to the entire human race and become dominant modes of expression. You know, none of these people at Twitter, I don't think any of them really thought, well, let's just generate the greatest device ever known for massive society-wide abuse. You know, I think they really believed everything they said about empowering people, about fostering communication. It's just that if you don't know anything about how people actually are, when you create this unfettered communication, you can get really strange consequences. And I think Trump is one of them.
So we started with you going to the Frankfurt Book Fair and feeling like you've arrived at your own funeral. Many a writer who walks into the Frankfurt Book Fair and finds that they are the most celebrated author on the show floor would be pretty thrilled by that. Why was it your funeral? And where do you go next?
It's a strange thing to work on a book that is really, at its heart, a critique of capitalism. And then this is not a critique of them, because I think it's wonderful to have any publisher put that much support behind a book. But it is weird when you're looking at 3,500 tote bags with your book's title on it. And you're like, is this why I'm writing? And yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's a weird thing. It's nice to have people support the book. It's genuinely nice. That's what you want. And I realize that I'm in a position of unbelievable privilege in that regard. At the same time, it's like everyone ends up in merchandising, you know, and it's not really what I necessarily expected or wanted. But I think that's just the way it goes.
Well, Jarrett Kobeck, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The book is I Hate the Internet, a useful novel against men, money, and the filth of Instagram. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Jackie Liu. Thank you very much for listening.